In the mid-1970s, artist Fiona Clark was taking photographs of Auckland's queer scene. At the time, the inclusion of two of her images in New Zealand's first major survey of photography, The Active Eye, caused such a fuss that the show was forced to close at several venues. 4 decades on, and a new documentary directed by Lula Kuchiara recounts how Fiona Clark overcame a range of difficulties to become one of the country's most successful and respected social documentarians. The documentary made of her is Fiona Clark Unafraid. It's screening as part of the New Zealand International Film Festival. And she joins me now. Kia ora, welcome.
Kia ora, Kim.
How did you feel about having a documentary made about you?
I was quite excited, but also I was sort of surprised in a way.
Not abashed. I mean, you seem quite comfortable in front of the camera.
Well, it took a while to sort of work out how it was going to be done. So, yes, I'm used to sort of fronting and I'm used to speaking up. And so I didn't find that difficult. It was more whether I was going to do it or not, I think.
And what persuaded you?
Lula seemed incredibly sincere. And she'd set some parameters, like one of them was it would be an all-woman film crew, which I thought was wonderful. And, you know, it didn't matter if it took 2 years or 3 years, we would do it. So there was quite a lot of negotiation, and I was quite happy with that.
First things first.
Yes.
Very sorry to hear that Nancy Girl died.
Oh, yes. Well.
People will know Nancy Girl if they have a look at the documentary.
Yes.
She was your goat.
Yes.
And she seemed a very jolly goat.
Yeah, she was very old. That was the extraordinary thing. She every day, some days she'd be lying asleep and I think, oh, Nancy. But I have to sort of wake her up because she was almost 30 years old. She was an extraordinarily old goat.
Yeah.
And she never kidded. She would run away, jump the fence, go and visit, because I'd got her from the neighbour's goat farm when they set up milking goats here. They changed from dairy to milking goats. So I'd got her as a kid through that. And that was a long time ago. So anyway, she'd run away and go and visit them and they'd ring me up and I'd walk her back down the road and, yes.
You'll miss her.
I miss her because she was so efficient at grass control.
Yeah, grass and weed control, they're great things, goats. What don't they eat?
And she's also, she's just good company.
Now you live...
Yes.
In the old Tikorangi dairy factory in Taranaki.
Yes.
You have lived there since 1975.
Yep.
Which means, if I do the maths, that you bought it when you were 21.
Yes.
How did that come to pass?
Well, I mean, I was at Elam, and it had just happened, the Active Eye piece had happened, and it felt like I needed to go home, and I'd convinced a friend who I'd been flatting with and living with that, and he was from Stratford, he was a painter, and he was gay, so we decided to buy the factory together. And that seemed like a really sensible thing to do. And it was a bit like a retreat from the city. Our time at Elam had ended. And people weren't that keen on the way we lived, in a way, within the art scene. It had just started that controversy about the black and white images, but by then I'd been doing colour, and it seemed an opportunity. And the place was really cheap, was so cheap that we could afford to buy this property with this huge building for studios and painting and do whatever we wanted. And we'd be totally independent. We wouldn't have to rely on the system or commercial enterprises or doing other things to survive. So that was the choice.
Let's talk about the controversy over the active eye. People can see, by the way, some pictures of your pictures on our webpage. What were the two pictures that caused such a fuss that the show had to be closed down?
Well, I'd been to a gala dance party with friends, and I'd photographed friends dancing, and I decided to print them as a series. So I printed them on an 8x10 piece of paper, beautiful hand prints, and I'd put the images to the side because I'd wanted somebody to write around the edge. And one of the friends was Carl, and he was at law school, and he had the gift of the gab, and we chose him within a group. This is my friends and I, that he would write something around it. This was what I'd wanted him to do. So Carl wrote on the work. Carl wrote how he felt that evening, what it was about, and people took great offence. They didn't take just offence to the words. They took offence to the fact that these were queer people dancing, enjoying themselves, and also there was language. So
there was language?
The text. And the text,
it was language.
There
was language.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Is that right? So it was all a bit, you know, avant-garde, was it?
Probably, but I didn't, I mean, I wanted to, I thought that this was a beautiful series. There were 10 in the series. That these were work I was doing. This was talking about what was happening. It was a gay liberation party we'd had, or at the university cafe. Everybody was there. And it was a record of that night. And part of it was this written text on the words with these little very nice printed black and white images, very rich. And I knew all the people in the photographs, so it didn't seem a problem that that was it. And I decided I would submit two of them to this open call for contemporary New Zealand photography.
And what, did people protest? I know Patricia Bartlett had a say.
Yeah, people were pretty outraged about the work. It closed exhibitions. People put the work into gallery directors' offices and people could privately view it.
Oh, Lord, like a sort of porn movie.
Yeah. And then it came to the Auckland City Gallery and they issued a notice of prosecution. So the police had to go to the gallery to view the work. So they were placed on the gallery director's office, at the time was Ernie Smith, and the police went to view them and said, just don't show them. And Ernie Smith cancelled the whole show. He said, we can't show anything. So they closed the gallery doors. Anyway, that was the last time the works were seen, was on the gallery director's table. And then the whole show was packed and went to another venue. When they got to the another venue, the works went in the crates. Someone had taken them.
And they've never reappeared to this very day?
No. I had interesting conversations with people about where they went, but I think they probably got destroyed. I think someone threw them in a bin.
Binned them,
yeah. And so they've never actually been shown again at the Auckland City Gallery, although they own the collection, and we only showed them again in Auckland, but not at the City Gallery, at Art Space in 2016.
Oh, okay, so they weren't part of the Go Girl.
Yeah, they were, but that never got shown in Auckland.
Right.
Yeah.
Because?
Because they chose not to show them.
Do you think that this afflicted your career?
I think it did. I mean, it didn't stop me from still making work, but it did mean that I lived quite a different life.
Would you not have gone to Taranaki had it not been for that controversy?
I probably could have been offered other options. Yeah, mm-hmm. People didn't want. You know, I wasn't really an option to re-enroll at Elam and do another you know, like masters or anything, or go somewhere else. It wasn't seen as a, it wasn't seen as acceptable, the practice I was doing at all. So I sort of retreated back here, and that was it. And it, yeah, so it did change, but it didn't stop me being a practicing artist.
You mentioned a controversy over the black and white. What was that?
Oh, the black, those were black and white images. So
because you didn't tend to do black and white.
No, I hadn't. No, I decided, so that was early work, and then I embarked on colour from the end of 74 right through. So.
And I understand that you had to develop your photographs yourself because you couldn't trust Kodak to do it without censoring them.
That's right.
Is that true?
Yes, it is. People had jobs at Kodak during the holidays, and people always knew that if a film came through that someone was processing, then someone else might look over the shoulder and just put it in the bin or wipe it or slice it.
Good grief.
So, yeah, there was, I mean, if you look at early work and if you go through those early albums of, say, history of certain clubs, you'll find Polaroids. Polaroids were quite common to use, especially if people wanted something in colour. Or else you may know somebody in the camera club or a private photographer who would develop the work at home, mostly black and white, but very rarely colour. So early colour recordings of that history, of the gay, queer communities, is usually Polaroids. And there's a really beautiful, some beautiful albums that Te Papa hold that have early Polaroids that I know about because I've seen them and wish them to be in Te Papa because they're so beautiful. But colour was something that you risked losing the film if there was anything controversial that went through.
Blimey, those were the days, eh?
Yeah, those were the days.
Ha! When we protected our children and parents from seeing the most extraordinarily offensive things. Ha! What were you setting out to do? Were you taking photographs of your friends whom you found fascinating and beautiful? Were you also making a political statement?
I think I was doing both. I mean, I mean, this was Auckland in the early 70s, so there was, it felt like a really vibrant scene. There was gay liberation meetings in the Quad at university. We'd go over to those sometimes. There was parties. There was the KG Club, and there would be a ball or something, and it would be a very private sort of gathering amongst friends. And those were my, and I was recording that, but I also felt that it needed to be seen because it was extraordinary. You know, the people were making costume to actually be who they were. There was, you know, it was a very different world. And I really wanted to record it well. And that was part of it. And I knew the politics of it. I'd been part of that politics. Yeah.
You came from Inglewood. You were born in Inglewood.
Yes.
Did your parents respect your choice of career and what you did with it?
I think they did, yes, surprisingly. But
I mean, Inglewood has a certain reputation,
yes,
for being a conservative bastion, to say the least.
Yes, it does. My father, I think my parents were both from the Depression, and so education they saw as a way out of the world of, you know, milking cows or farming. I really sort of think that they just fell into that way of life. And my father used to say the war really mucked things up. He probably would have wanted education, but he couldn't have it. He went and milked cows, and yeah. So They were very... My father told me that my grandfather had met Amy Maud Bock when I was 14, and I was surprised at this information.
Amy Maud Bock was the woman who dressed as a man, was she not?
Yeah, she was. And my grandfather had met her at Morco because I had aunts and cousins who worked in boarding houses. So Amy Bock was part of that working class boarding house scene in New Zealand. And it was sort of a surprise to me. And I remember trying to have conversation with my mother about it. And it was a very interesting fact that sort of I got told that your grandfather had met Amy Maud Bock, you know. And she, you know, wore men's shoes. So there were some hints of acceptance of another world. And they didn't stop me from going to Elam. Then I got a job in Auckland in the summer of 71 and 72 to work to have enough money to go through Elam. They didn't say, give me money and say, here, go ahead. They said, well, if you're going to do it, go and do it.
That family farm?
Yes.
In Inglewood is still there?
Yes.
And you visited in the documentary. What's happening to it now?
Well, I still own a small piece of land of it.
Is it being farmed?
It's got a lease. I lease it to somebody, yeah, and there's some cattle on it, and I run a web camera on it as well, and there's lots of trees, and it's a fairly passive piece of land.
You set that web camera up years ago for your parents. This seems such a delightful idea, and obviously... the director of the documentary, Lula Kuchuria, thought the same thing, so that your parents could watch the farm when they weren't there anymore.
Yeah.
And did they?
Yeah, they did. So it was the view that my father had from his milking shed, his cow shed. So he liked the mountain. And he built a new milking shed when he had enough money, and the view was that view, and it was like the best view on the farm because you had to view the mountain. And I used to take my laptop down and log in, and they would be able to watch the mountain having their dinner.
And you've still got the webcam running now?
Yes.
So it turned into a kind of an artwork?
Well, it was always based as a piece of... based on the idea of time, it is an artwork, really. It's very passive, and also because the mountain now has personhood and legal entity, I'm fascinated by that.
You were very involved in environmental issues, and you supported the local iwi in documenting the dire strait of the Waitara River. Can you tell me a little about that?
Yes.
This is Te Atiawa's campaign.
Yes. I mean, when we lived at the factory here and we'd bike to Waitara to get groceries, I mean, we lived a barely subsistence life. We used to go to the river mouth, and someone told us, this was Tertius and I, that there was a meeting and we should go because we were sort of talking about how the river was dirty. So we went and everybody got up and offered something. Like, it wasn't that many people. People got up and talked, and it was my turn. So I just got up and said, I can take photographs. This is what I do. And so when people came up after and said, okay, then we'll pick you up and we'll take you here and come up and have a dinner. And people sort of checked me out, and obviously it just worked, and I just went off and photographed on the reefs, eeling, everything, and documented it all, and then produced an album for the Waitangi Tribunal hearings that was presented, and people spoke to the photographs. I would do a visual presentation, and other people would speak. That gave people the opportunity to speak to the work, so they spoke to the images, and it was very empowering for people to have that done. And at the time, the health department was saying things like, people boil their shellfish, you know, don't eat raw food. Well, flick up a picture of someone, you know, eating kina or raw mussels. So that was my early involvement, and I've continued that right through now with, you know, the gas industry here. And yeah.
How's the Waitara River these days? Any improvement?
Well, it has improved, but it's tidal, so it still has, and it has a lot of runoff from dairy farms, so we still have issues with the cleanliness of the river, yes.
I like the idea that you're living in an old dairy factory and growing your own soya beans to make milk. That seems like a personal statement.
Oh, I think that it is. Yes. You can do these things.
Who can?
Well, some people can. If you set your mind to it, you know, if you really want to do these things, sometimes we're able to do it.
Are they easy to grow, soya beans?
No, it's actually my neighbours that grow them as well. So they're not prolific. It's a bit like growing chickpeas, garbanzo beans. You have to really nurture them. Yeah, but I grow bananas. I've grown bananas now for 30 years.
Edible bananas?
Edible bananas, yeah. Wow. Edible bananas, avocados. Tukurangi's got a very beautiful climate.
It sounds like it.
As long as you're sheltered and you've got, good water supply, lots of good compost, you're away.
Sounds like you enjoy living on your own.
Yes, I do.
But you are not antisocial.
No, I'm not. I make sure that I'm not, because otherwise it doesn't make sense to me to produce work and document things around me without having some, you know, contact and grounding of what I'm doing, yeah. So I go to Waitara once a week and I work in a recycling shop, a community shop that's community-based for the town. I've done that now for a long time, but that really grounds you about living in a community.
Your friend says on the documentary that people see you as eccentric and have in the past been very rude towards you.
Yes.
In what way?
Oh, well, I mean, recently I saw an internal email that described me as, you know, an aged environmentalist. Sadly, I'd had a car accident and done me no good. So people quite often don't accept people that are different in small communities still, I think.
No, yeah. Although it's odd, isn't it? Because sometimes completely the reverse is also true.
How do you mean?
Well, I don't know. I was saying about Georgina Beyer, for example.
Yes. Exactly. There's obviously people who don't accept me for what I do or what I photograph and who I am. But on the other side is there are people in the town of Waitara who value, you know, the friendships I have and have kept me here, in a way. So there is, yes.
You did have that terrible road accident.
Yes.
1977, I think.
Yes.
In which, afterwards, they wanted to remove your eye, which had been seriously damaged, and you said no.
Hmm.
Can you see anything out of that eye now?
It's very blurry, but that's because it has very serious corneal ulcers on it. But I could get, if my good eye is bad, I can get to the kitchen bench and make a cup of tea. I can be still slightly independent, and that's why I wouldn't let them take my eye out in the, all those years ago, because I kept thinking, well, you've only got two of them. If one, the other one goes, you'll be blind.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's why I have it. And I always think that one day there'll be some magic surgery. I mean, it's pretty amazing that recently the macula in my good eye collapsed. And with
macular degeneration.
No, a macular hole occurred in my good eye.
Oh, Lord.
I know. And so, but this amazing procedure. And voila, I have my vision. I don't have straight lines very anymore on, say, a pole or something. There's a little bit of a dent, but that's because the macular hole hasn't quite healed itself. But if I'd had the other eye out, I would have been totally blind.
Ah.
I know.
Good thinking.
That's what I think. But the macular surgery is... it's wonderful. So I'm hoping, you know, that one day somebody will be able to do something, because the scarring on my bad eye is the problem. It's not, it's scarred. It's got huge scar tissue on it. And that is the problem.
I mean, in many ways, you were lucky to get out of that accident with your life.
Yes, I was.
Somebody's asked me to ask you these two questions, and they seem to be perfectly reasonable to me.
Yes.
Talking about the photographs you were taking in the 1970s, they say, were your subjects always happy to be photographed, or was there some hesitation given the treatment of some people in the queer scene in the 1970s?
Not people were photographing my friends. It was part of what we did. We went out in a group and I would take the photos. Or if I went to Mojo's, I wouldn't go at a time. Then it was a problem, like in a weekend when there were other people, it was more public. And I knew people, so that's... and yeah, it wasn't a problem.
Also, it was showtime. I mean, you get dressed up to the nines and put the slap on, you want to be photographed, don't you?
That's exactly right. And if the photographs were good and I could take them back and give people these beautiful little colour images, then that was a really good trade, a really good relationship.
Second question is, if you could choose between having your youth now or as you did in the 70s, which would you choose and why?
I would choose that time, because it taught me to be pretty resilient. And I mean, I'm of that era. I am of that era.
It's hard, isn't it? You have to imagine yourself as being somebody completely different in order to answer that question.
Yeah, I can't. I can't imagine myself, and I can't imagine myself not doing, taking photographs of friends at parties and doing that and recording those things and then being able to reproduce them and produce that work, produce those artworks.
I'm upbraided by a listener for suggesting that you're antisocial. They say they think I meant asocial because you are... definitely pro-social, and that's quite an interesting definition. I didn't mean that you were averse. No, I suppose I did. Antisocial was the wrong... he's quite right. Antisocial was the wrong word to use. What are you working on now?
Well, with the oil and gas industry, you know, out my windows, I document the changes in our landscape. I continue to document Waitara, the town that's nearby me, which I think is fascinating. I'm trying to make more spaces here where I live and make sort of installation work or carry out like an installation work that I can open occasionally parts of the factory for people to view. Because I have a lot of collections of things, and the factory for me is a fascinating building. There's parts of it that I just think are wonderful.
It really is. And it doesn't appear as if... I mean, it's not as if you've done a do-over on it and turned it into a house. It's still the factory.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a factory. I live in a factory. Everything, you know, it has factory scale. The walls are concrete. It's not a house. It has, it really is a factory.
And obviously you don't feel a need for a house.
No, I don't.
Would you describe yourself as a collector?
Yes, I am a collector. I do collect things. I try and limit what I collect. I'm, Yeah.
Working in the community shop, the Corso shop, would would be an encouragement to collect more of something or other, would it not?
Well, I can be specific, see, and I get great delight out of finding things and passing them on, or, yeah. I can do personal shopping for people too, which is wonderful to do.
You mean from the shop?
Well, if something comes in and I think of somebody, I think, aha, that's for them. So I quite often do that. Yeah, and you can also, I can upgrade the whole time and bring something home, I don't want it, I can take it back.
Exactly.
So lots of people do that with, hoko shops, you know, second-hand shops. They'll find something, then they take it back, and then someone else finds it.
What did you use, the hoko shops, you say?
Hoko is the second hand, you know, trading, a trading shop.
Ah, that's
hoko-hoko
a nice word.
Trade, yeah.
I'll use it. Thank you so much. Thoroughly enjoyed the documentary. I thought that Lula Kuchiara did a lovely job.
Yes.
Good to talk to you. Thank you. Fiona Clark, the documentary that's been made of her, directed by Lula Kuchiara, is called Unafraid. Fiona Clark, Unafraid. It's screening as part of the New Zealand International Film Festival. And the details are on our webpage.